digging deeper into the lives, the stories, and the passions of people on today's education landscape. This is In Conversation on Voice Ed Radio. I'm your host, Stephen Hurley. Well, today we turn our Voice Ed Radio transmitter to the south, to New York City, to catch up with Kari Lazar-White, who is a social entrepreneur. He's an author, an educator, an activist, an attorney, and the founder of Brotherhood Sister Soul. That's a Harlem-based youth development organization that wraps its members in powerful programs, meaningful support, and a whole lot of love. Stay tuned for a conversation with Kari Lazar-White. Kari, welcome to Voice Ed Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. We're all in the middle of course, the pandemic shutdown and making all sorts of connections. And we were talking just before we came on about Zoom fatigue. Would you call it Zoom fatigue?
I definitely would call it Zoom fatigue. I mean, I think that it's almost a trick on the senses. You know, we've become accustomed to a phone call and to hearing the voice of, you know, whether it's work or a loved one, you know, you can process that. But there's this element of kind of meeting via screen, which I think maybe is similar to like a dog seeing its image on a television. You know, you're there, but you're not really there. And you lose so many kind of human moments of interaction on Zoom. Obviously, it's better than a phone call often, but it is a struggle, I think, to connect only in this way.
Well, it's a great segue into our conversation because for... many, many years you have been doing the work that you do, connecting with young people in Harlem and in New York City. And I'm wondering, and maybe we can get to it, about how you're continuing to make those connections through this time. But tell us first about Brotherhood Sister Soul.
Brotherhood Sister Soul is celebrating our 25th anniversary. I co-founded the organization with my childhood friend, Jason Warwin, in 1995, and since then we've built it into a multi-service, multi-dimensional youth development organization. We proudly kind of wear the mantra of a social justice organization. We are helping young people to understand the conditions they were born into, to process that information, and to become social change makers, to change those conditions. And so there's really three elements of what we do. The first is direct wraparound services. As you described it, for young people from 8 until 22, providing support and guidance and education and love to young people. International study in Africa and Latin America, environmental programming, job training, college guidance. You know, all the services that you would expect young people to need. Also protective services, though, that are realities and economically distressed in Black and brown communities here and so many places around the world. And so also legal representation and mental health support. It's about kind of holding young people and creating a web of support so that they can, you know, really reach their dreams and overcome the realities that they were faced with. And so we want them to be kind of political voices, artistic voices, social justice organizers. And then the second leg is that we train educators across the country on our model and also internationally. We have formal programming in Brazil and we've done some formal programming in Bermuda as well. We've trained about 3,000 educators around the nation and internationally. And then the third piece of what we do is really try to change the conditions that, again, our young people are forced to face because of economic conditions, because of being born Black and brown in this country. And so we work around educational access. We work around criminal justice reform, as it's called. We work around issues of environmental justice as well. And those are multifaceted, but we really want to create a change to the actual conditions that young people have to face every day.
So how do you personally come to this work? What inspired you to begin this back 25 years ago? That's a long journey.
Yeah, it's the only, quote, work I've known. You know, that's why some folks call us social entrepreneurs. Jason, my co-founder, was in just the second class at Echo and Green, which is a kind of incubator of new ideas in the nonprofit sector. And so before kind of social entrepreneur was a term, we were that. We began the work when we were seniors in college. you know, I think that for me, the guidance, the drive has really come from family. I come from a family deeply involved in change movements in this country, from the civil rights movement to the women's movement to the labor movement, on both sides of my family. You know, Black Americans from the South. My father, you know, born and lived in segregation for 25 years. And so, you know, being very directly connected to that experience. My mother, raised in New York City, the daughter of a Jewish immigrant from Russia, then Romania, depending on where you draw the lines, who was very involved in the union movement. He was a communist. He was fought in Spain. You know, I come from kind of two lines of folks when he fought in Spain, of course, against Franco as part of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And so, you know, two lines of folks who went to prison for their beliefs in this country. My grandfather called in front of HUAC. My uncle on my father's side attacked by then Senator Jesse Helms for, you know, seeking freedom in this country. You know, I think that that's what I was raised in. It's inspired me. And the continual inequalities and inequities in this nation drive me every day to try to create a bit more justice and a bit more equality.
So in a sense, it's the only work you've known, but it's probably the only work that you could imagine yourself doing.
Yeah, I think I identify as an artist activist. You know, I'm a writer. I've, you know, written a novel and written published essays for many, many years. And so those are the two kind of forms of work. I really consider them callings. I think in the same way that an artist feels like you just kind of demand that you have to paint or you have to play the saxophone. You know, I feel a desire and a need every day to write and to fight for more, again, justice and equity.
I believe it was Rilke the poet in Letters to a Young Poet that said, if the first thing you do when you get up in the morning is think about writing, then you're a writer.
Right.
I'm vastly paraphrasing.
I have a good friend who say writers write.
Right.
You've got to do it.
So that's right. That's right. Well, you have a compelling theory of change that I found on your website. And again, there seem to be three parts to it. And I found it intriguing because of not necessarily the individual parts, but when you combine them, it is representative of your theory of change, a theory of how change is going to be made. So the first part about the multi-layered support, guidance, education, and love, I mean, many organizations might just stop there and say, okay, we just have to embrace these young people before us. But then you go on to say we want to teach them to have self-discipline and form order in their lives, which I think is powerful for all of us. But then to develop that sense of agency that they can actually impact the world that has so impacted them and their families and their story. Talk about how those combine and is one more important than another? Or do they kind of come up in different ways at different times? Why do you call that a theory of change?
You know, I think when you talk about raising children, which is really the work at its core, whether you're raising your own children in a family or whether you've been, you know, provided with the opportunity to raise others' children and through work like this, we realize that it's not just one thing to raise strong adults. I mean, what does it mean to be men? What does it mean to be women? What does it mean to be leaders in our community? These are questions that so often we don't really investigate. I mean, you expect boys to learn what it means to be a man and girls to what it means to be a woman, but what does that really mean? And so I think to create all of the support systems to help young people navigate the difficult adolescent years is so key. We are working with a Black and brown population in New York City that is coming from conditions through no fault of their own, simply where they were born, where they're attending substandard schools, where they do not have access to jobs and food equal to other groups. There was an article recently published that, you know, the disparity in age expectancy, lifetime expectancy in Manhattan, one of our five boroughs here in New York City, on the Upper East Side in a wealthy, overwhelmingly white community is 90 years. And in Central Harlem, where I live, in Harlem, where we work, the average life expectancy is 70 years. So it's 20 years of difference. I mean, these are fundamental things that have to do with health inequity and school inequities, issues of poverty, and that are so deep. And so when in this country you have that reality and you have the reality of race and racism in this country for so many generations, then what you have to do with young people is provide, yes, support, guidance, love, and education to overcome those realities, to take responsibility for their lives. You also have to teach discipline and order, which I think has a long history in this country. And you see this a lot at historically Black colleges and universities in this country of, you know, talking to young people about what your responsibility is in spite of all that you were faced. And so kind of connecting to that legacy. But then I think a lot of organizations stop there. I think you need to talk about this third stage as well, which you highlight, which is, do you provide opportunities and access so that they can develop their own agency? I mean, a truly free person, a person truly able to build a stable life, has their own agency to do that. And it's not, we're a youth leadership development organization, but we have to develop leadership within our young people so that they have their own agency to go out there and transform themselves, their families, their lives, the world, hopefully. And, you know, I think you can't really do youth development work fully without all three of those pieces: embracing young people, teaching them what they need to overcome the realities that they face, and then kind of shining a light so that they can step forward and really do this on their own.
When you talk about agency in that context, is it always a sense of changing the status quo, or is there a sense in which agency means being able to live within the current structures? Is there always a sense of activism attached to that agency?
No, I think it's both. I mean, I think there's also just an agency to speak out on your own behalf. I mean, I think there are things that you often find in, you know, wealthy communities or middle-class communities where people will advocate for themselves. And I think that for our young people, when they go off to college, let's take a very concrete example, we want them to feel comfortable advocating for themselves if their financial aid is reduced. We want them to feel comfortable advocating for themselves with a professor and going in to seek those office hours. There are times where people feel more intimidated to do that because they are not coming from an environment oftentimes where that is expected in the same way. I've been at, you know, kind of elite progressive schools in the city in New York, and they're constantly teaching analysis and teaching young people to synthesize and to speak out for themselves. And all too often in some of the traditional public schools here in the city, we're teaching rote memorization and fill in boxes and standardized tests, and not the same kind of ability to really look at the world critically aware and to make decisions for yourself. And so, no, that's not all social justice. That's also about just advocating for yourself and having the agency that your voice matters and that you have a right to speak out and to speak up.
So the concept of voice and the idea of voice is so important, and we talk about it a lot. I've spent 30 years in the public school system here in Ontario, and that was one of the mantras of progressive education is student choice, student voice. How do you see that manifesting itself in the young people that you've worked with over the past 25 years? What would it be an example of that agency coming through in voice?
I think maybe I would give two examples. I think one with regards to kind of the organizing and social change piece that we were talking about. You know, New York City has a public school system of 1.1 million children and a budget of $34 billion a year. And it categorically does not provide a sufficient education for young people. Only 70% are graduating from high school, so nearly 400,000 are in danger or not graduating. And our young people, to their credit, took on the issue of increasing guidance counselors, mental health support staff in schools. Right now, there's one guidance counselor, the aggregate, per 400 young people. In some schools, it's 1 to 1,500. You know, you've been in public schools for 30 years. I've been working in them for 25, attended them for nearly a decade. You know, you don't get the kind of support that in so many of our public schools that our young people need. And so our young people created an exhibit speaking out about this issue. They advocated. They created art. They spoke to public elected officials. They demonstrated. They drew attention to the lack of support. And we've seen a change due to a citywide youth-focused movement, not where we need to go, but certainly a change in how this issue is being looked at. And We know that there's been a mental health crisis with young people across economic strata, and obviously coming out of this COVID crisis, the pandemic will also result in a lot of trauma, and we'll need even more support for our young people. So I think that's one example of kind of the activism side. And then on the other side, you'd have kind of, to your point, you know, the artists who have come through the organization, brilliant alumni artists like Zora Howard and the Peace Poets and Elizabeth Acevedo, all came through the organization and are telling stories, stories of Black and brown girls, stories of bisexual adolescents, stories of the immigrant that weren't as widely told in their generation. And they've contributed powerful voices to that. And I think knowing that their experience is important, you know, is something that they would all say that they certainly learned or was nurtured at Brotherhood and Sister Soul.
To what degree does it work with, cooperate with existing organizations like the traditional school system? Do you work hand in hand with them, or do you sit outside of them? How does that dynamic work?
We're an independent, you know, 501c3 nonprofit. We have many partners. So we have environmental partners, local farmers from upstate New York who we bring in food for our youth-run farmers market. We have organizing partners. We have art partners. And yes, we have school partners in DOE as well, where we meet with principals. We come to talk to you, explain our program, and hopefully you would welcome us into your school with the clear benefits that our program provides to the school, and we have our statistical outcomes as an evidence-based program that would speak to it. So I think on an individual level, we work with schools, but on a macro level, we are organizers and activists, and we are critical of how DOE educates children across the board. There are wonderful principals and wonderful teachers and wonderfully committed people at DOE, but as a system, it is not providing the education that our young people need, and so we remain independent to criticize that, to criticize elected officials. We were critical of then Mayor Bloomberg. We're critical of current Mayor de Blasio around these issues. And I think our independence is extremely important. But we also partner with folks. And I also think you can disagree in a way that is not, you know, so often you go online and it's so visceral and vicious, right? I mean, I think you can disagree with people without calling everybody names. And so, you know, I think that there are different ways to do it, and we try to be constructive in our criticism, and we have lots of partners we work with.
In doing this work, you see and come to see young people specifically and probably generally as well in a different way, and I'm wondering about some of the assumptions that those of us that are outside of your work might bring to that context, and the assumptions that that maybe you would like us to challenge. How is the way that you're seeing young people different than maybe the way that other people see those same kids?
Well, again, I think, very specific to the population we work with. You know, New York City is a city of close to 9 million people, and a third of all New Yorkers live in poverty or on the poverty line. And I think these statistics are important. They frame the work. So you're talking about one third of all New Yorkers living in economic difficulty. You know, there are often ways of talking about people who are coming from economic poverty. So I'm even careful about the words that I use. You know, you look up the word poor in the dictionary. It means deficient, means lacking in value, having no worth. So to call a person poor is very different than to say they were born in economic poverty or economic difficulty. And I think that follows with judgment. So we don't look at our young people from a deficit model. We don't look at them as lacking. We don't look at them as less than. We look at them as equally strong, beautiful, powerful people who need other avenues opened up because of the economic issues that they faced, because of the racial oppression that they have faced. So I think one is that we don't look through a deficit model at our young people or at our work as an organization. And that's extremely key to us. The second is that if you look at social change movements, again, throughout this country in the United States, and I think I would, you know, submit in almost all places in the world, social change movements have been led by young people, whether it's the uprisings in, you know, South Africa and Soweto and the apartheid, anti-apartheid movement in the United States, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the LGBTQ movement. you know, the anti-war movement that brought down Lyndon Johnson was led by college students. And I think we live in a time where too often the voices of young people are not heard from and listened to. And I think as an organization, what we try to do is to elevate those voices now. They're not the leaders of tomorrow, they're leaders of today. I think too often our schools suppress youth voice. I think too often our schools do not create platforms for young people. You can't really talk about education and educational change and transformation without young people being a part of the conversation. And I think too often adults are prescribing what that looks like, and we forget that teenagers and people in their, you know, young 20s transformed opportunities for equality and equity in this country in so many ways and continue to do that. It's young people, I think, who have driven much of the environmental conversation across borders around the world in terms of what the future of the world will look like. And so I think that's one of the great disservices that education broadly, again, not all schools, not all institutions, but broadly, don't listen enough to young people and respect young people enough as leaders.
I grew up at a time when that Victorian mantra, children should be seen and not heard, you know, was resounded through my household. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure there were times when children should not even be seen was what was going on in my dad's mind. And I'm thinking in some of the work we do, even in education, even in formal education, there are some kids that we sometimes wish we're not there. I mean, our life would be a whole lot easier if, you know, this context were different. And I know that's changing, and certainly the youth voices around the world. But I think all they're often held up as anomalies. You know, and so Greta Thunberg, for example, becomes Person of the Year. It's kind of an anomaly. But you're
correct.
You're in a place where you see this every single day, and that's got to be powerful.
Yeah, I mean, I think that too often we also put young people in buckets, you know, good kids and bad kids, difficult kids and easy kids. You know, one of my colleagues I work with always, you know, her philosophy is, quote, there are no bad kids, just children who haven't met the right adult yet. You know, it's a very different approach to youth development. And, you know, I think if you only create the space for the kind of, you know, elite youth leader, it's the same problem with only creating spaces for elite adult leaders. You know, that leadership comes in lots of different ways, different colors, different genders, different backgrounds, different economic levels. You know, the fact that we continue to look at only those who have been educated in elite institutions to lead nations almost across the board is a deep problem. Right. I mean, I think that's one of the things that stood out so much for Lula as when he was a leader of Brazil. That's why he was so much of a threat to one of the, you know, largest developing economies in the world, is that you had somebody who came from a working class workers movement who was running a country. And why is that such an aberration? Why is it that even when you have, you know, a transformational leader like Barack Obama in this country in terms of what he represents, of course, he's still went to two Ivy League institutions. I mean, he still fits within the ideals of what a leader should look like. And so I think that affects how we look at youth leaders as well, that there's this idea of what a youth leader should look like. And sometimes youth leaders are going to, you know, they're going to turn over the table. They're going to change things in a much more fundamental way.
Yeah, turning over the table. That's a great metaphor. And I'm thinking, you know, we have documentaries that come out and intrigue us. And I remember years ago reviewing the film Waiting for Superman, which is about charter schools and education across America, but centered a lot in New York City. Just recently, we saw in our family Brooklyn Castle, which was about the chess team at IS-318. And actually, we had Elizabeth Spiegel on last week talking about that program. But my sense is that for many of us, it seems like those people other than us. And I'm wondering, in your work, how do you, I guess, battle that sense of other, that these kids are other? I'm not even phrasing that right, but how do you prevent that sense of other from taking over our perspective?
I guess this is a conversation about, you know, pronouns. It depends on who the, you know,
yes,
who,
no,
who
it
the
is.
We and the our, the our or the you. I think from my perspective, again, we can't do our work in this country in this context without talking openly about issues of race and class. And so since the founding of this country, Black people have been otherized by the white dominant population. It's just a fact of law. It's a fact of the Constitution. It's, you know, today people love to debate facts, but, you know, the reality is the country was founded and Black people were deemed 3/5 of a human being. Black people were subjugated to 13 generations of slavery and 4 generations of segregation and completely separate societies until literally 50 years ago. So, you know, that other is always there. The other is there in the killing of Black men by police that continues so rampantly in this country, the threat of the Black male. You know, these realities continue. And so anytime you're having a conversation about, quote, urban education or what's going on in, quote, inner cities, that's code language for talking about Black bodies and Black people. And so that's always a part of the conversation. I think that, you know, when we talk about education in the country, we have to talk about those issues or we could never, you know, really move education forward in a multi-ethnic, multicultural country like the United States that has such a horrific history and unfortunately present with regards to race. So that's constantly there. It's a part of the conversation. I think it goes back to our theory of change, though. That being said, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to move the conversation forward? How are we going to change our institutions? How are we going to deal, hopefully, finally, with the aspirational goal that America has always been, right? America's never met the words on its paper. It's never allowed people to truly have equality across racial, ethnic, class lines. You know, so those of us who are activists and organizers, and I would submit also educators, our work day in and day out is to try to create more opportunities so that, you know, countries can live up to their creeds.
And I have to tell you that here in Canada, where I'm based, we're relatively speaking just starting to come to terms with this in our context. And here on Voice Ed Radio, we just completed a 5-week book study on Desmond Cole's book, The Skin We're In. Mm-hmm. And the same language, the same issues are staring us in the face, too.
Yeah, and I think, and look at the framing of that issue. So often, for many good reasons, Canada has been in the lead to the United States, whether we talk about healthcare, or we talk about lack of, you know, mass shootings and violence. There have been so many ways that the nation of Canada has gotten credit that it deserves. But so often the language about race and class in Canada has been from the white, dominant, wealthy class. And so I don't believe, of course, that the majority of Indigenous people in Canada, the majority of Black folk who immigrated or people who immigrated more recently from other countries or Asians would say, oh, it's the land of perfect equality and equity, right? It's a very different narrative depending on who you ask the question.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the projects that that actually make up your program. And I know you're not doing this all alone. And I'd love to get a sense of the dynamic of what it means to be part of the organization, especially as a young person.
Most assuredly not doing it alone. We have an incredible staff. I think one of the keys to our success is that 40% of our full-time staff and 60% of our frontline youth development staff are all alumni of the organization. So they're folks who went to college for the most part, some to grad school and came back and are now doing work with the next generation of BroSys. And so, you know, what our young people would say is, I think, the core of where we started this conversation, the theory of change. They would say they come to BroSys because they feel supported and guided and loved. They come to BroSys because they learn about who they are as Black and brown people in this country and in this world. They tackle issues around gender identity and sexuality. It's an open space where they can talk about and ask questions and investigate who they are. I mean, I think those are kind of key reasons that they're there. We have very diverse programming that's arts-based and environmental-based and rites of passage-based and work-based, but all of them run through with the same theory of change and the same concept that they will have long-term involvement by staff over multiple years who will provide comprehensive wraparound supports and will be there to investigate and support all these issues as they come up. And I think that's what runs throughout the program. And whether we're working with 8, 9, and 10-year-olds or we're working with 15, 16, 17-year-olds, they would say it's home that is what BroSys represents. If you look at our logo, the four themes on our logo are positivity, knowledge, community, and future. So in addition to our theory of change, those four words drive everything, you know, that we do. We're thinking about the future of young people. We are building, we are forming a community. We are constantly seeking knowledge. And all of that is done through the lens of trying to create positivity in the world. And I think, you know, that's the fiber that holds everything together.
So when you talk about this this organization outside of New York, you mentioned that you have national training programs and people involved from all over the country. When they ask, why does it work? What do you tell them? I know it's not a simple answer, but what are some of the indicators and of impact and success?
I think that the out-of-school time, we call it here, you know, the out-of-school time, so, you know, after school and summer hours, weekend hours, youth development is often misunderstood and misconstrued by people. It's something that sometimes people seem to have a hard time wrapping their head around. You know, I often with educators kind of pivot and talk about a school when you say what works. You know, we all know what wonderful schools look like. You've been in education 30 years. I've been in it 25 years. You could blindfold either one of us and put us in a school almost anywhere in the world, and we would know within about 15 minutes if that's a good school or not. They're just, you feel it. You feel the culture, the energy, the smiles on young people's faces. Are there caring teachers? Is there devoted leadership? I mean, we know what good schools look like. And so to me, it's the same thing with youth development. It's that when we connect with people who are really running organizations or working in organizations that are youth focused, that's youth centered, that are really about the support of young people and not about a different agenda, that are about being there to respond to all the issues that come up, that are attentive, that are guiding, that are loving, that see this work as work that's a calling. If they're helping young people to be analytical wherever that analysis may take them, even if it does, quote unquote, turn over the table. All of that is absolutely key. And so that's what we look for in who we work with and train. And one of the things that's been affirming is, you know, my work has allowed me to travel a lot nationally and internationally and to see youth development and educational programs around the world. And I think that the models are there everywhere. I think the question is whether there's really the political will to duplicate that, to support teachers with what they need, to ensure that our schools have the resources they need. You know, just a quick kind of pivot example of that is there was a big expose about the issue of homelessness in the New York Times over the last week. And, you know, just a very striking example of what I'm talking about is that to deal with the homelessness crisis, and it is a crisis in the United States of America, New York City, 10% of all children who attend public school are homeless. 10%. 120,000 children are homeless and attend school. To deal with that issue is the same cost as one aircraft carrier. And so the choices are in front of us. Do we want to build schools, support young people, deal with homelessness and its connection to education? Or do we want to build another aircraft carrier? And in a certain way, I think it just frames when we say what are good schools look like and how can we respond to this crisis. I think we know. I just think the question really is whether there's the will to do something.
So 25 years of this particular work, you must have days when you go home and you're on cloud nine. It's are so convinced that you are doing powerful stuff, and you are. On the days when you don't feel that way, when you feel a little down about something that's happened, are there a couple of stories that that you carry with you that that revive you and allow you to get up the next day and get back at it?
Yeah, this first part is there are definitely many days where this is heavy work. If you choose to, you know, be involved on the front lines or whatever kind of framing you want to use around it, if you kind of dedicating your life to taking on these issues of inequality and equity. There are many hard days. The gross inequality in this country is revolting. That's kind of the word I would say, and it can be very hard to deal with it on a daily basis. I think I feel sustained less by the stories looking backward and more by the future looking forward. It's that I come into the space and the smiles and energy and commitment and fortitude of young people inspires me. And I certainly am inspired, I guess, looking at the alumni who are on staff would be looking backward. That would be looking at success stories every day that these women and men have returned to dedicate their life to the next generation. That inspires me certainly each and every day. I think the legacy in the community of Harlem does. You know, Harlem is a tough community with a lot of complications and issues, and it's also a beautiful community, a beloved community of art and culture and significant history. And it inspires me as well to do the work every day.
And this may seem like a question that's already been answered, and it certainly has in a lot of what you've said, but if we were to embrace this, really scale up our efforts and take all of this to heart, what's waiting for us as a community? What's waiting for us as a nation? What's waiting for us as a world?
It's a better world. It's a more informed world. It's a more politically engaged world. It's a world that does not produce the kind of gross leadership we have from Brazil to England to the United States. You know, it is a world that is more gentle with one another. It's a world that understands the humanity of one another, that's less likely to go to war, that deals with, you know, the key inequalities that the world continues to face, that responds to the lack of gender equity in terms of education in so much of the world, so that girls get the same education as boys, that allows people to love who they want to love. I mean, we have formed a beloved community at BroSys, and I think that so much of that is applicable and scalable. The question is, will we do the work to really educate our young people, not just for a test or not just in an academic way, but in the broader kind of way of investigating the ethical and moral dilemmas of our time? And what we do, I think, too often in education is we're afraid of those conversations. And in turn, young people are learning, if they're lucky, from parents who are dedicated and loving. But if they're unlucky, they are learning from online or peers that are directing them in the wrong way. We abdicate our responsibility to do that part of their education, and the result we're seeing all around the world.
Well, Kari Lazar-White, thank you so much for this. Thank you for your work, your insights, and your time today.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me, and thank you for having these conversations.
And you can find out more about the organization that Kari Lazar-White co-founded 25 years ago by visiting their website, brotherhood-sistersoul, that's SOL.org, brotherhood-sistersoul.org. I'm Stephen Hurley. You're listening to In Conversation on Voice Ed Radio. Thanks for being here. This podcast series has been produced and edited using Hindenburg Broadcaster, one of the many tools that you'll find by visiting Hindenburg.com. Many thanks to Hindenburg for their support of our work here at Voice Ed Radio.